The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please welcome hometown heroes John Dorenbos and Larry Platt to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
From the bag, baby! Yeah, what's going on, man? Rock on, thanks for coming. Yeah! Come on! I like that jersey, honey. Come on! Hey, man, what's going on? Hey, thanks for showing up. This rock star. I'm going to tell you this. We're going to have some fun, so you better buckle up. Hey, this is my man, Larry Platt. He's from here. And did an awesome job. If you've read the book, great. If you haven't, this guy right here, man, he's unbelievable. So I'm glad that we partnered up. So
yeah, I provided the energy, as you can tell.
Yeah. And this is going to be very lightly scripted, because I kind of... So we'll see where this goes.
So, Magic Man.
Yeah, man. Rock on.
Congrats.
Thank you.
I want to start with something you say in the book. This book is about finding meaning in both the tragic and the everyday. It's about how to learn resilience against all the odds. It's about looking in the mirror and refusing to see a victim staring back at you. It's about disregarding the doubts of naysayers and shutting up the self-doubt each of us secretly hears every day. It's about thinking of forgiveness as an act that sets you free from bitterness and resentment. And it's about how to ultimately build a life when arguably the worst thing that can happen to you happens when you're 12 years old. That's really powerful. And let's talk about August 1992. What? August 2nd, what happened?
Yeah, so, I lived in a place called Woodinville, Washington. We had a sick house. My dad was working with Microsoft and Bill Gates. My dad was my hero. I mean, look, what little kid doesn't want to grow up to make his dad proud, hopefully, right, in a normal home? He coached my teams, president of Little League. You know, now I was at the age where he took me to work. We can go hang out, and I was becoming an adult, right? And that's when you spend time with your dad. Teach me how to change the tire, the oil, and stuff like that. My mom was a hero for a whole different reason. Now, I'm not going to say I had a learning disability. I'm not going to go that far, but my reading comprehension was really bad, like really, really bad, right? So my mom started a reading program at the school to basically make reading visual to help kids like me learn, because I was in the special reading class, you know what I mean? And I'll never forget when all of a sudden Pat Conniff came into that class because he liked my mom and she would give away candy. And my mom showed me that you can be different and you can be special and still contribute to this world. In fact, the world needs you because you're going to contribute in a different way. So on August 2nd, 1992, I was 12 years old, and I was across the street at a friend's house. And when I came home, my dad had murdered my mom. It was really bad. And he used a bench grinder and a sledgehammer in the garage. That changed my whole life. And so I went into foster care for a year and a half with my sister. We went into the most intense therapy you could possibly imagine. My dad was tried for second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 13 years, which in the state of Washington, max penalty for second-degree murder was 13 years. And, there it is. That was kind of the start of where, really, my life got completely thrown upside down and life began.
And so you're 12 years old, and this, and there's no history of any violence in the family. So this, an idyllic, you say, a Brady Bunch-like childhood.
Yeah.
And then therapy starts. And how do you find yourself after something like that?
You know, so, look, put yourself back when you're 12 years old in elementary school. You're trying to figure out who's who. Kids are mean. They're bullying. And I was that kid. I got bullied a little bit. And I was super insecure. I felt like I had a sign over me that said, hey, I'm the guy whose dad killed his mom, and I'm the guy seeing a shrink, you know, I'm the guy seeing the therapist. And what happened is I was with my foster home. I was sitting on the curb outside of the porch, and I'll never forget looking across the street, and the neighbor kids blew a bubble, and this bubble floated away. And I'll never forget, I thought that was the answer. If I could jump in this bubble and float away to a land where all my problems could disappear, that's the answer. Wash it clean, I'm good. And the bubble popped. And that was my aha moment of realizing that if I had hopped in that bubble to float away to this land that didn't exist, I would have fallen twice as far and hit twice as hard. And so that made me realize that running's not the answer. So the next day I go into therapy, and I say something really screwed up, right? And I realized that the therapist didn't care. He was actually proud of me. And I was like, huh, that's weird. I was trying to get a reaction out of him. And the reality is this guy wasn't judging me. So as soon as I realized that this therapist isn't judging, in fact, he doesn't even care what I say. It's, can you get your heart and your mind on the same page and can you speak it into words? And I don't really care what that is, but as long as that's how you feel, you're good, kid. And so that was kind of the aha moment when I realized that a therapist isn't judging me, not telling me if I'm right or wrong. It's just, hey, let me help you figure out you, and then let's push you off.
And, you know, one of the things that in many ways this book is has multiple love stories. And Annalise, his much, much, much better half, is
way one, better looking. I'll tell you that. One,
that's a low bar.
Look who's talking!
Also a love of two things that helped you find yourself, which one was football.
Yeah.
But the other was and remains.
Yeah. So magic to me, I attribute this to saving my life. Now, I wish I was cooler. I wish I was a rock star, right? But unfortunately, when I was 12, 13 years old, I saw a magician who was 16 years old. And then when I was 14 years old on TV, I didn't see Jimi Hendrix. I didn't see Stevie Ray Vaughan or Slash or Eric Clapton who could jam guitars, right? I saw a guy named Bill Malone who was a card guy. And so I found out this, that when I sit down and I shuffled cards as a kid, it was the only thing that I had that the world quieted. It was the only thing that I had that when I heard the sound of the click of the cards and the riffle of the shuffle, I was just a kid, and I wasn't lost in the world of therapy, moving around, my dad going to prison, trying to figure out life, not just losing my mom, but losing my mom and my dad. And so those things stayed with me my entire life, and that's what I do. I shuffled cards. I didn't get into football until high school. I was this size in high school, so I thought I was going to be, everybody thought I'd be huge, right? And then I just stopped growing. But I'll never forget my buddy Kevin Johansson comes up to me and goes, yo, dude, you should play football. And I'm like, dude, no way, man. Football's for dorks. I like magic. And he looked at me and he goes, yo, man, you can hit that guy and not get in trouble. Well, God dang, let's give that a shot. That actually sounds pretty cool, you know? So I went out there, I put the pads on, I hit this kid one time, and I'm like, yeah, I like this game. This is a great game. And what ended up happening is it was a total accident, right? But guess what I get to do during the day? I get to hit you. I get to get all of this aggression and anger. I had a natural outlet for aggression. And then at home, I turn on Yanni. I'd light a candle. Yanni, track number 9, Felista, on repeat. We had 2 CDs, Yanni and John Cicada. Which would you do on repeat, right? I ain't doing John Cicada. It's just another day. I can't do it. And so I would sit there and shuffle. I'd listen to Yanni, track number 9, Felista. And it was a great balance, right? I got to get rid of my anger during the day, and I got to nurture my soul by shuffling and making sense of the world at night. And ironically, the card tricks that I was learning at the time all correlated to where I was in life. The first things I learned how to do were do riffle shuffles, mix the cards up, and actually put them back together in numerical order while shuffling. It took me years and years and years to do this. And then trying to do it in speed, and then trying to do it while talk to you. And then trying to do it in a performance when I can actually talk to you, do this, and I'm calculating everything. I'm 2 into 1 into 4 into 3. And it's like a Rubik's Cube, everyone's different. But ironically, guess what it was? It was taking things out of order, taking things that were messed up, and trying to make sense of it, and putting it back in order. Which symbolically, when I got older, I blew myself out of the water because that's what I was trying to do with my life, is make sense of all the chaos. And so that's where I started.
And where did you get this notion, which I think is beautiful, that you found yourself, but that all of us ought to do this, which is talk to ourselves, not listen to ourselves. Give us some examples of that. Yeah. and the genesis of it.
So my mom died. We opened our jewelry box, and guess what there is? There's 3 chains, right? One for my sister, my brother, and me. She was going to give it to us when we all turned 18, but she obviously passed away. So my family, eventually about a year and a half later, I move in with my aunt, who's my mom's sister, and my grandparents, which are my mom's parents. And when I moved in with them, we moved down to Southern California. My sister and I, they gave us these necklaces, okay? And I wear it, and it was, dude, I loved it. It was the only thing that I had on my mom, right? So I felt connected. And so now I'm 14 years old. I go down to Huntington Beach, California, and what happens is I jump in the ocean, and guess what falls off? Destroyed me. Oh, dude, I got out of the water, and I went like this, and it wasn't there, and I literally was just destroyed. And so I'd go back and I'd try and look for this thing. I couldn't find it. So about a week later, I went to that spot and I just looked up in the sky and I finally realized that the story I tell myself is gonna make all the difference in the world. That's what's gonna change the world. And I go, Mom, I get it. That necklace was never meant for me. In fact, the only reason I wore that necklace was to bring it right here and deliver it to the whale. Because I know you always wanted to go to Australia. You never made it. So I went ahead and dumped it off in the ocean so the whale could take it to Hawaii. and the sea turtle took it to Australia. And when it got to Australia, it did the Philippines, Japan, and now you've been all over the world. And so now all of a sudden, when I thought of that necklace, I wasn't sad. There was a purpose to it. I found motivation in defeat for the first time. I found motivation in something really bad. And it motivated me to find happiness. And now, guess what? I don't need to go to the cemetery and see a stone. Instead, now I know that anytime I see the ocean, that necklace has been there. And guess what? So has my mom. So I can just look out in the ocean and talk to her. And that's the story I told myself. Still do.
And that transcends, you do that all the time now. You would do it before you would snap the football. You'd say something to yourself that you might want to share here.
Yeah, there's kids here, so earmuffs. So everything I do is a story in my own head. And people are like, yo, being a long snapper, a lot of pressure. And I actually told myself two things. I told myself I was, don't ask me why, but I was Matt Damon playing myself in a movie. And I don't know why it was Matt Damon, because Jason Bourne, right? Obviously, Dornbos. And I thought about if I was an actor, Matt Damon, and I was playing a long snapper in a movie, I'd be perfect. So just go act like you're a badass. Okay, that's easy, right? And then I had a guy tell me early in my career, he's like, hey, what do you tell yourself before you snap a ball? And I go, I don't know, don't screw up. He's like, that's terrible, that's negative reinforcement. You're actually reiterating yourself to screw up. He goes, how about you, should I say, there's a kid here. Hey, how about you say this, fire it in there, don't be a pussy. And I go, it's pretty good. So I'd go out there as Matt Damon, as Jason Bourne, and then right before I'd snap a ball, I'd be like, dude, just fire it in there, don't be a, and then sure enough, sure enough, that's what I told myself before every snap my entire career for 15 years in the NFL. Yeah.
The secret to football, you've just learned.
Yeah, right? But it helps, right? Hey, clear the noise. Get rid of the chatter. Get rid of the noise. So if I could have gone out there and shuffled cards for 10 seconds before every snap, I totally would have done that.
Something about, because of what happened to you as a kid, rules didn't always have to apply. Share with us this hard-to-believe story about how you got a college football scholarship.
Look, dude, here's the deal. All right. I want to be a rock star. I got three problems. I can't sing, I can't dance, and I can't play an instrument. So check that off the box. But the only reason, so I had a chance to play baseball. I was a better baseball player than football player, and I had a chance to play big time. And the only reason I said no is it was too slow, right? I don't know if you guys can tell, but I kind of got a lot of energy, you know? So... I wanted to run out of a tunnel in front of 100,000 people. You want to know my motivation to play college football? That was it. If I went out and I ran out in front of 100,000 people, I felt it, I probably would have been cool if I never played again. And so I go to high school. I was a really good player. Didn't get an offer. I was a little bummed. So all of a sudden, junior colleges are calling me. And there's some really good ones, but they got a lot of guys. And Golden West Junior College, it was right down the road. They were 0-30. Okay, so basically what this means, they hadn't won a game in 3 years. Okay. So I figured, if I can't play there, hang it up, you know? So I go to this school, right? So what do? We lose 10 in a row. We go 0-40, all right? So now I'm with the Bad News Bears, played every game, which is great. But not a lot of big-time schools are recruiting Golden West Junior College when you lose 40 straight, right? They don't exactly see the diamond in the rough. And so that was great. Anyway, so I make a highlight tape. Now, you guys are all going to relate to VHS. Right, you guys remember? That's a little grainy. We didn't have HD, right? We didn't have internet. We didn't have 20 cameras at practice. We had one. So I put my highlight tape together. And I got a few of me long snapping, which long snapping is there's a guy that kicks it. I look between my legs, and I snap it to him, and he kicks it. That's all I did. I literally played like four seconds of play, maybe six plays a game, 24 seconds. And a whole year, I played maybe 3.5 minutes of actual football. So I remember I put my highlight tape together and I'm killing it, right? I'm putting this tape together, it's awesome. I got some high school thing of me snapping, it's okay. But as I was getting my clips, dude, I couldn't help but notice this dude, Nick Heinley. And we rotated, I was 47, he was 48. Look, we're both kind of short, pudgy white guys, right? Who could tell the difference of who's who? So I got the cables in the back of the VHS, play, pause, record, you know, there's a little grain in between each one. And I took all my highlights, but then Nick would just crush people. I mean, dude, he hit people so hard, he would knock himself out. So I just took some of his crushing hits. So now you got this guy that's like, you know, running with receivers, he's fast, and then you got this guy just mauling people. But then I couldn't help but notice this guy, Tim Thurman, who was the long snapper at junior college. He was 6'8", and better than I ever was. So I was like, his snapping's better than my high school stuff. Just put it on there. Now look, I knew I was good enough. All right, now, so I don't feel like I'm what Lori Loughlin, what they did with that. Like,
right.
Okay. So, I didn't, you know, and so, dude, I'm gonna tell you right now, that's the first time I ever made that joke. That shit was funny. I'm using that in my show. All right? Yeah. You guys were just my test market. I'm gonna keep that one. But the reality is, I knew I was good enough. I needed an opportunity. I just needed to get in the door. I knew I could do it, right? Because the guys that I played against were all going D1, and no offense, I crushed these guys. I'm like, I'm in. So what I do, I sent the tape out. My best friend was at UTEP, and they need a long snapper. And, like, he had also played with the other two dudes that I played with. So he gets the tape, and he's like, did you say that's Dornbos, coach? Don't worry about it, Paul. Get me in the door. So they gave me a full ride. I went to University of Texas, El Paso, technically because I was Tim Thurman. But I'll tell you what, man, I snapped every game for 3 years, 2 Pro Bowls, most consecutive games played in Eagles history, going into the 15th year of my NFL career. So, I was proud of it. And none of it would have happened. Yeah. And about 5 years ago, I got a call from Tim Thurman. He's like, hey, John, I heard your story. Awesome. Glad it worked out for you.
I love that story. Obviously, it's funny, but also it dovetails with the point of the book, which is you decided at some point, thanks to therapy, I think, to write your own story.
Totally.
And as you say, it's up to each of us to choose. It's within our power to choose happiness and to make our lives happen.
Dude, I learned this. Happiness, it's not an emotion. It's a decision. And I say this all the time, man. There's a moment when every one of us are face down on the ground. We're just treading water. We got to survive, right? We just need a break. We just need a moment just to catch our breath. Every one of us can relate to that moment. I don't care how old you are. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care what religion you are, what language, what race, what your title. It doesn't matter. But the one thing we can all relate to is the moment that we struggle, the moment that we think we're defeated, and the moment we think we're going to fail. Now, in that moment is a decision. That right there, I believe that's what separates people. Do you stand up and live in vision, or do you live in circumstance and become a victim? What you tell yourself in that moment is going to dictate the life you live. Me, I stand up and live in vision. I stand up and tell myself that I'm not going through all this pain and suffering for no reason. Something better is going to come out of this. You can tell yourself your story. And what I like is I literally talk to myself out loud, right? But I can listen to that voice of doubt in my head, which we all have. It's just, can we just contain it, right? Or if I speak where I want to go out loud, I'm going to hear it. Not only am I going to say it, I'm going to hear it. And guess what? That's where I'm going to go. Everyone, if you guys want to just hack my email or my garage code, it's where I'm going to be in 5 years, right? And so what happens is my password's always changing. But you know what else is happening? I'm writing, I'm typing, I'm speaking, I'm communicating, and I'm talking to myself out loud every time I put my password in where I'm headed. It might be an emotion, a place, it might be a physical thing, a spiritual thing, it may be a family thing, it may be a materialistic thing. But either way, 100 times a day, I put that thing in there, and I'm telling myself where I'm going. It's a powerful thing, man. Words are a powerful thing.
And the book contains, after in two, I forget what year it was, you got a divorce. That was before you
Yeah, which, by the way, if anybody gets divorced, I say this, congratulations.
And your password was?
Yeah, so when I got divorced, I married somebody here, and just, you know what, we just weren't meant for each other, right? So divorce for me was the best thing that ever happened to me, actually, which is kind of sad to say that. But when I got divorced, all my passwords, and I'm not making this up, my buddy goes, hey, John, I need to get in your laptop to get that video file, you know, for the show. It's locked. What's your password? Oh, yeah, it's free at last. It's really bad. It's not nice to say. But I did remarry. I love my wife. She's amazing. So I'm all for marriage. Just make sure it's the right one.
Did I mention she's his much, much, much better half?
Yeah.
So all this stuff has happened to you. And then a few years ago, we had enough material for this book, but yet you decided to have an aortic aneurysm in your heart. And a lot of people are, in Philly especially, know about this story. But what they might not know is what's really moving in the book. I think maybe the most moving thing in the book is the 4 weeks at University of Pennsylvania Hospital after life-saving heart surgery, in which you decide to be like Andy Reid. Explain that.
So basically what happened is I knew heart terms, but I couldn't really define it, but I can define it now. I had a murmur, which means blood's leaking all over the place, right? And so what happened is my heart's pumping and not enough blood's getting out of my heart because it's falling back into it, so my heart gets way too big. So then there's a vein that leaves the top of the heart. It's called an aorta, and that should be about the size of a dime or a nickel, right? That's everybody's aorta is about the size of a dime or a nickel. Well, mine decided to just blow up like a water balloon, and now that aorta was the size of a Coke can. And so imagine the vein right here in your arm, and then like from here to here, it's the size of a Coke can. If that thing pops like a water balloon, lights out. Alan Thicke, Bill Paxton, and then John Ritter, they all died of what I had. And so now here I am playing football with blood leaking all over the place out of my heart and a 6-centimeter aneurysm of my ascending aorta. They're like, dude, one hit to the chest. And in my position, I didn't so much get hit with helmets by the chest, but you get that D lineman that just, you know, right there that you're like, oh, I felt that. Yeah, thank you. So if I get a hit in the chest, they're like, dude, you would have had a much higher chance of dying than living. So we do a physical. They find it out. I then, I don't really, look, here's the way I look at it, right? I treated it like a game, right? It doesn't matter. Emotion to the side. Andy Reid always would say this: if the captain keeps his cool, the ship keeps their cool. If the captain loses his cool, the ship loses their cool. So I told Ani, friends and family, keep your cool. They'll keep their cool. We got this. And so we found the number one surgeon in the world. I get choked up every time because of the way the Eagles handled it and the resources that were thrown to me from every professional sports team around the world was overwhelming. And I get a call from Jeff Lurie, and he said, hey, man, I don't care where you got to go in the world. My jet's already on the runway in Louisiana. You take it anywhere you want. You take it for as long as you want. You see every doctor you want. You don't even ask. They know that they're going to take you anywhere, anytime, for as long as this takes. And I literally was like, fuck, why can't we be going to, like, Hawaii or something, babe? You know? So, and this is what's even worse, right? Because, like, every time I would take a flight as a kid, tell yourself the story, I would close my eyes and pretend like I was on a jet. That's all I wanted to do is just ride in a jet. And then sure enough, here we are on a jet. And I'm like, Jeff, I wish I had a better story for you, but we're only flying 2.5 hours back to Philadelphia. So I go back to Philly. When I get to the hospital, we have our surgery. And my wife and I notice that everybody's mad, right? Everybody's looking around. Everybody's like eyeballing us, staring at us. Everybody's pissed off. And then we realize that everybody's just scared. And
other patients, you
other mean? Patients, yeah. And other patients and their families, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. So I looked at my wife. I go, hey, baby, the captain keeps his cool. The ship keeps its cool. It's time that we kind of we bring this team together. And so sure enough, so this is what you do. When you have open heart surgery, the big goal is to get to the other side of the room and get your juice box and then slide back to your room and you'd walk like this, right? And I'd have my pillow. And when you cough or sneeze, you have to squeeze this pillow to equalize pressure. Otherwise, you had it. Zipper club, baby, come on. It's the sexiest thing in the world. Dude, and I told my wife, tattoos are cool, but I think scars are sexy as shit, man. We saw it, dude. So anyways, sorry about the cussing, man. Hey, so... But you got to squeeze this pillow to equalize the pressure, otherwise your sternum pops open. So right, so I go into this room, right, and there's like this 65-year-old dude, right, and I knock on the door. Hey, what's up? He goes, what do you want? I got to say it because I'm quoting. I go, you look like shit. And the guy looks at me and goes, so do you. And then I go, you want to take a slide and go get a juice box? And the guy's like, yeah, kid, let's go. So me and this old man, we're like this. Right? But what happened is we opened the door. What happened is we started talking. What happened is if we can make a smile in this room, we can change the way this room feels just by the way we talk to ourselves, just by the way we view ourselves. That's the difference. Change the tone. Change the vibe, man. Make it what you want. And so my wife and I, that's what we did. I took the things I learned from my favorite coach of all time, Andy Reid, and I said, babe, captain keeps his cool, ship keeps its cool. It's time to change the vibe of this ship and get everybody on board. And that's what we did. Every day we took a walk, got our juice boxes. Next thing you know, one guy comes out, da-da-da-da-da, and there we were, man. It was cool.
I love that story. Yeah.
Can I say one more hospital story? Hey, if you guys need, if we got to cut it, it's all good, but if we stay a few minutes late, I don't really care, so it's up to you guys. This is a story that still chokes me up. And, you know, when I knew that this guy, Mike Tolan, wanted to make a movie about my life, this is a scene from a movie.
Was this at the restaurant?
Oh, God, that's another scene from a movie. When my mom died, I started biting my nails on the steps of the courthouse. Couldn't stop. And probably one of the most self-conscious things I've ever been, besides the, this is bad. You want to know why I got picked on in school? I had a pair of red sweats in second grade. They were amazing. They're the most comfortable sweats in the world. Problem is, I liked them so much that I wore them in second, third, fourth, fifth, and then had a picture of me in sixth grade wearing these same red sweats, which were like spandex, right? So it doesn't matter. So what happens is, I start biting my nails, and I was really self-conscious of my nails my whole life. And my fast performing style was because I was self-conscious that people were going to stare at my nails. So I've tried everything. You know that lacquer? You know the stuff that you painted on there and you don't bite your nails? Dude, that stuff tastes so good. I'm going to tell you that right now. That stuff's amazing. And so my wife that I'm with now, we get together, and what happens? I change a few things about me I didn't like, and one day I look down, and guess what I don't do no more? I don't bite my nails no more. My wife's the greatest person in the world, so here's the story. I would always say goodbye to exes, right? Just, hey, if I'm leaving, hey, goodbye, I'll see you later. And for whatever reason, I never say goodbye to my wife, not one time. I always say, I'll kiss you soon. And so it's the morning of the surgery, and now we got to separate. And that's probably when everything hit me. I get wheeled down this hallway. I turn a corner. It was the first time I didn't see my wife, and I got choked up. And I wasn't sedated, right, because I was the first one of the day, so they actually wheeled me into the ER. I actually put myself on the operating table. I looked over and saw the saws, the scalpels, you name it. I saw it. And I was like, okay, this is real. Like, this is happening. And the anesthesiologist comes out. She goes, hey, honey, I'm like, put you to sleep. I'm like, okay. And she goes, what island do you want to go to? Huh? Yeah, just tell me where you want to go. I'll put you to sleep. You'll take a little nap. You're going to go on a little vacation. You're going to wake up feeling good. And I go, you know what? Take me back to my wedding day, the beach in Mexico with my wife. Because it was the best day of my life. And I never tell my wife goodbye. I always tell her, I'll kiss you soon. So she puts the mask on, I fade away. Surgery was supposed to be 4 or 5 hours, ended up being close to 11. And so at the 9th, 10th hour, they come out, and the anesthesiologist gets my wife. Hey, honey, come on over here. Hey, John's fine. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on in there. We fixed it. It's going to take about an hour and a half to sew him up, and he'll be all right. So she's like, oh, my gosh. So now the anesthesiologist is walking out, and she stops, turns around, and she said, oh, one more thing. Your husband made sure to tell me to tell you that he'll kiss you soon. And that's when she said she lost it. So that was cool for me. Yeah.
So I don't want to give away the ending, but...
Should we or no? It's up to you guys.
So John did not see his father for 26 years, and... when his daughter, 2 weeks before the birth of Amaya Love.
Not to interrupt, this all happened 5.5 months ago. So.
So, why did you seek out your dad? It's been 26 years. Yeah. Your last conversation with him was, you testified against him.
Yeah.
And then.
Which, that's hard, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Testify against your dad, huh?
Yeah. At 12, yeah.
At 12.
So, why did you seek him out?
I basically hit him up, and I said, hey, I got no expectations, don't want anything from you. And if you want to get together, let me know. And it comes back to finding motivation in defeat. When the really bad things happen to us, if we can make the world a better place and learn from it, that's what you do. And you take the road less traveled, and you never grow unless it's hard. If it's easy, you don't grow. If it's hard, you grow. And so I reached out to him, and I realized this. If I'm a deadbeat dad, you know what the reality is? You know what society will do? They'll cover for me. Oh, God, I feel so bad for his daughter, but... if you knew what his dad did to his mom, you'd probably understand, right? And I don't believe that. I don't think that it should be an excuse for failure. So instead, I wanted to sit with him for the first time. Last time I saw him, I said F you to him. He said F me, F you, kid. And he was behind glass at Walla Walla State Penitentiary. And then he walked away in handcuffs and scrubs. And 26 years later, we sat down. And I realized I wanted to relive that entire relationship. The good, the bad, the ugly, what could have been and what should have been, the pain, the anger, the betrayal. And I wanted to relive all of that to find motivation to be a better dad, to realize the dad I can be for my daughter that I never had. And that comes down to the story you tell yourself. I didn't want answers from him. I didn't need explanations. I didn't need anything. I was there for me. And I was there to say 3 words that I never said in my entire life out loud. And that's, I forgive you. I'd never said those words to anybody. And so my journey to see my dad right before my daughter was born was symbolic. I wanted to have lunch with him. And when my friends would have lunch with their parents, I'd always meet him. Hey, John, you want to go? Heck yeah, I want to go. But I would always meet him. I'd never let him drive me because I wanted to walk in and see a father and a son sitting together because I never had that. I had father figures, but it's not the same. And I'm not trying to diminish those father figures. It's not the same. And so sure enough, me having lunch with my dad is symbolic to an entire relationship that never existed, to him destroying my family, to years and years of pain and suffering, and me trying to figure out my life. That's what having lunch with my dad means. And so if you open the book and you read the dedication, go ahead and read it. I'll read it. Yeah, and now I was out of divorce. When I met my wife, I was divorced for a year. I was flying my own plane, performing, playing in the NFL, wanting nothing to do with nobody. Like, I'm free. And then when I met, and I had a wall, you know, I had a wall up. So when I met my wife, I told her, she turned my heart right side up. So the dedication in the book is to those two. For Annalise, my wife, who turned my heart right side up. And Amaya, who will always be able to have lunch with her daddy. And that means right there that I'm going to be a better dad than I ever had. And I've taken the steps to do so. And yeah, so that's why I went on that journey. And it's all in detail in the book, so.
In between five and 10 minutes, we'll open it up for questions. But do we have any, by any chance, any Eagles fans in the?
Yeah, baby.
So, a couple things on football in here. One is, I have to tell you, you read this book and you really fall in love with Jeffrey Lurie.
Yes,
he really seems like a mensch. Explain.
So hold on. My reading comprehension is really bad. Okay. So when Larry would, we were first talking and he said that, I'm like, no, he's cool. And he was like, yeah, he's a mensch. And I'm like, no, I like him. He's cool. And he's like, no, it doesn't mean Grinch. It means, right. Just making sure, Larry, just making sure.
And explain the Super Bowl thing. Because you were traded from this team.
Yeah. So there's a coach, special teams coach, right? And they wanted to go younger, cheaper. And I'll be honest, I would have done the same thing, right? It was the right move. Right? I was 37. This kid's 24. He's still with the team. Rick Lovato, amazing snapper, amazing kid. And you know what? He deserved the job. But me, in my own ego, I'm like, you know, F that, right? Like, I want to be here, right? And when the whole thing went down, I'll be honest with you, Larry. I completely forgot the question. Oh, no, I got it. So I got traded, right? And in the moment, I think the GM thought I was going to be angry. And I remember looking at the GM and I was like, what'd you just say to me? Did you say you're going to trade me? And he goes, yeah, I think so. I go, has there ever been a long snapper traded for? And he goes, yeah, I don't think so. I go, well, what are they going to give you? They're going to give us a draft pick? I go, when I came out as a free agent, I wasn't even a draft pick. Shoot, 15 years later, I'm worth more than I was when I was a kid. New Orleans, right? Come on, baby, New Orleans. I'm like, Howie, I'm going to be in an all-black uniform, 37, pudgy, very slimming. This is good, right? And you can ask him. I told him this. I said, man, 13 games indoor. All right, let's do this. So they trade me. And the whole heart thing happens. And, you know, there's a bunch of people in the building. It was, you know, a CFO named Frank Amieni, the president, Don Smolinski. There's a security guy named Dom, and all these guys were Coach Peterson, punter Donnie Jones. All these guys were influential in this decision. And now, keep in mind, I didn't watch a game all year. Okay, I was on 21 pills, staring at a wall, drooling on myself. Metropole, right. So, the first game I watched was the NFC Championship, and I slide my feet over to the neighbor's house. I'm watching it, and literally, I'm not gonna lie to you guys. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. The Eagles go to the Super Bowl. Shortly after, they sign a guy named John Dornbos. He then plays in every single game, tying a franchise record for most consecutive games played. He played over a decade, every game. They trade him, and now they're going back to the Super Bowl? Awesome, great job, guys. Right? So then I get a little bitter, and my wife looks at me, and she goes, you know what the reality is, kid? You play, you die. You live, you win the Super Bowl. And I go, wow. So at that moment, I got really excited for my friends. Frank, Don, the front office guys, Donnie Jones, Darren Sproles, Jason Peters, Brent Celek, and just Nick Foles, all these guys I played with for so long. And then the phone rang. And it was the front office, and they're, hey, we want to take you. Really? Yeah, we told you that we're going to take you. And I was like, yeah, but I didn't really think you were going to do it. You know what I mean? So they ended up flying me to the game, my wife and I. And the night before the game, Mr. Lurie said, hey, man, I remember when I met you. I'm sorry if I drag this out. This is actually really funny. When Jeff and I first met, really had a discussion. It was in training camp when we were at Lehigh, and it was really hot. And as a long snapper, I would like practice for about 6 minutes, and then I'd have like 2.5 hours of just standing there. So I would have to go to the bathroom for 2 hours and go lay in the equipment room with the air conditioner, right? And Jeff came in and saw me one day, and I was like, oh, yeah, Jeff, no, I just had a buckle missing out of my pads. And you know what he told me? He goes, oh, I just come in here because it's air conditioned. And I was like, I literally go, no shit. And him and I talked, and we got along. And I told him I never want to coach. If I ever played a Super Bowl, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be as a player. So time goes by, and guess what happens? He says, John, we're going to win, and I know you didn't coach, but you're going to get a ring. And you're going to get a player's ring because you deserve it. So sure enough, they win. And then they call me, and the team presents me with the ring. And they basically tell me, hey, man, you were here a long time. You were part of the culture of this team, and this is a thank you. And I know you didn't play, but this is for you. And when you look at it, just think about how much hard work, the relationships that you had here, and your memories. And so for me, the Super Bowl is much different for me, that ring, than probably the other players that played in the game. When I was asked, what's your career goal? My career goal was, it was never win the Super Bowl, it was never get paid, it was never Pro Bowls. Believe it or not, I always wanted to be the oldest guy on the team. And like people would ask me, what's your goal? Oh yeah, I want to be the oldest guy on the team. And they're like, what? Yeah, I want to be the oldest guy on the team. Wouldn't that be cool? And to me, that symbolized that I would have the most opportunities for success. Because if my goal was to win the Super Bowl, you know what I didn't want to do? Win a Super Bowl and then never play again. Play 1 year, win the Super Bowl, and then be done. I didn't want that. I wanted opportunities to be successful. And when my family kind of got torn down, right, and I was trying to rebuild it, I wanted to bring pride back to my last name. And every team I played on was a sense of family for me. And I was never the biggest, never the strongest, never the fastest. But I always wanted the coach or the GM or the front office and the owner, whoever it was, that when my time was done at that place, I wanted them to look at me and say, you know what, kid, I don't care who we could have had. There's nobody else that I'd rather have but you. You guys hear those phones?
They're calling each other.
Yeah, right? Even though you were told to turn your ringers off, you did. So I know we're getting on a tangent, we're running out of time, but let me tell you what happened. A couple years ago, I'm speaking, screen goes out. The speaker before me does a flying scissor kick into the screen and loses it. Event planner's freaking out, right? So I'm like, dude, this is great. I go on stage. I'll follow that guy today. Well, you can't do worse than that, right? So I'm like, yeah, this guy's amazing. I'll kill this one. But you know what he did is he let the outside world affect him. And so it was like the necklace that fell in the ocean. Find motivation and distraction. So after that point, I realized that all I got to do is change what happens when those phone goes off. So now I tell myself that every time a phone goes off in a show, there's somebody up there saying, rock on, honey. I'm front row. It's the only thing I can say. So in a moment, I'm talking about how much my career meant, how much this city and this organization meant, a phone rang. I believe in those signs. I believe there's someone up there saying, rock on, honey, I'm front row. This is how I'm telling you I'm here. You do your thing. Find motivation and distraction, man. And all of a sudden, things that we think are hiccups or speed bumps, they don't hold us back. They push us forward. It's a beautiful thing. So when I got that ring, to me, that ring symbolized an organization saying, hey, you were here a long time, and I don't care who we could have had. There ain't nobody else that we would have picked but you. Showed up every day, did your job. And it's a respect thing. So may every one of us take pride in our name. May every one of us realize that there's people watching us and looking up to us. Don't live in vision. Sorry, live in vision. Don't live in circumstance. And change the words in your head to find motivation and defeat. And I think we're going to rock the world. We're going to change the world and make it a better place for the people behind us.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
And I didn't really know this. And it's a really good thing I didn't talk crap on this guy. Because I see Frank. Who else is here? Is Don? So stand up. This is so cool. I mean, this is what these guys do, right? They don't have to be here. So on the far left, that's Don Smolinski, president of the Eagles. And on the right, that's Frank Gamieni, the CFO. So those are two of the front office guys, man. Rock on, dude. I appreciate you guys being here. You know, when they told me I was family for life, they mean it. So it goes far beyond just the field. So I love you guys. I appreciate 11 years of my life being here. And you guys changed my life in so many ways. And it's a big part of this book is my thank you to you guys. So I appreciate it, man.
And speaking of Philadelphia Eagles, the ethos of Philadelphia Eagles football, there's this two paragraphs on page 132 that if you're a fan, I just love this. Just read these two paragraphs. It's about...
Oh, dude, I tried to do my audiobook. I can't read out loud, dude.
The one that begins with, here's the thing.
I'll be honest with you, dude. I don't have my glasses. I can't read shit.
You want me to read it?
I really can't read that, dude.
Let me just real quick. This is after you were told at practice that you ran 18 miles an hour.
Oh, can I just tell them the story?
Tell that story.
All right, so... Dude, this is funny. I mean, I think this is funny. There was a short time there when we were experimenting with sports science, right? And Frank, you're probably going to laugh. You guys are probably both going, oh, don't tell this story. And they were all in, right? And it kind of, these few guys, it was like sports science is the reason we're going to win. Yeah, whatever, if it compliments, great. So here's what happens, right? Sometimes you can get so deep into something, you kind of lose a little common sense. So they would put GPSs in our jerseys. I love this story. They put GPSs in our jerseys, right? And they track how much you run, which is great if you're like Darren Sproles or a receiver and you're running a lot. But when you're a long snapper and you're not really doing all, whatever. My average running time in practice, okay, was between 4 and 6 miles an hour, okay? Which just to show you is about this. Okay? That's about my speed in practice. Brian Braman was the fastest special teams player at like 21 or 22 miles an hour, which is flying, dude. That's like a cheetah, okay? So the sports science guy comes up to me, John, whatever you did today, you got to do that every single day. Huh? Whatever you did, you opened up the lactic acid or whatever it is and your deep vein thrombosis and all the water coming out. And I'm like, awesome. So whatever you did today, I'm looking at the data here and the GPS says you ran 18.9 miles an hour, kid. Donnie, the punter, Donnie, who's slower than I am, I go, Donnie, look at this, man, 18.9, baby. So I go, what do you mean? He goes, look, we need to really get you to open up the hamstrings, right? If you keep running fast like that during the week, you're going to have a steady growth of improvement. So whatever you did today to get 18.9 miles an hour, you do that every day. I go, you know what, sir? I will do that every day. Just so you know, I didn't even put my cleats on, and I've been driving around the golf cart all day. I got you, coach. I mean, come on, dude. I've got 3 years of going 4 miles an hour. Now I'm the second fastest guy on the team. Come on. But I'll tell you what, we hit the straightaway. I actually thought we got up to about 25, so I was like, you might want to check that.
And it's that context, and then we're going to go to questions. It's that context in which you write, even if all the science behind it was dead on, the fad-like rush to embrace sports science as if it was the answer ignored the truth about what really makes for success in football. It's that band of brothers, bros being bros culture, that my man John Runyon, remember John
Runyon? You guys remember
Runyon?
John Runyon?
That John Runyon carried in his very being. I had to laugh when the science guys told us that having a few beers wiped away the benefits of 2 weeks of training. Well, let me tell you the football roster I want around me. I want a team of John Runyons. I want a guy who drinks whiskey straight and punches you square in the face, flicks his cigarette to the ground, and goes home. That's who I want. Rather than the guy hooked up to wires running on a perfectly smooth track attached to a parachute. No, give me the guy who has holes in his boots, who drives a beat-up truck, who drinks a beer in one gulp, and who, when you look at his wife the wrong way, just knocks you out and then goes back to eating a rare steak. That's Eagles football.
Yeah, man. Hey, let me tell you this real quick, and I know we're running out of here. John Runyon broke his tailbone. Broke his tailbone. He had a quarter or half-inch gap. And Frank, it was like half-inch gap in his tailbone. So this is what he does. Dude don't even miss a practice. Okay, I don't know about you, but if I break my tailbone, I'm probably going to be out for a few days. He don't even miss a practice. So now all of a sudden I go, John. And so we played San Francisco. So that's a six-hour flight. So all of a sudden I look in the back of the plane. 6 hours, John's like this. Can't sit down. He's just standing there, right? So then all of a sudden we play like Christmas Eve or whatever, and now it's like 1, 2 in the morning. We're flying back to Philly. I look in the back of the plane. John's like this. Dude can't sit down. He got a Sprinter van and put a stripper pole because he didn't have to hold it on the road. He couldn't sit down. Never missed a practice, never missed a game, never complained one time. Dude, you want to know the greatest answer of any football player I've ever heard in my life? I go, John, dude. And he's, imagine this, 6'8", you know, he's bare, pants pulled down to here, bent over the equipment table, like the table like this, and he's got masseuses rubbing the gap in his bone to try and get blood flow, okay? And he's like this, right? So I go by and I go, John. Yeah. I go, how do you play football with a broken tailbone? He stands up, he looks down at me, he goes, it's easy, kid, just don't fall down. Yeah, okay, yeah, I'll try that. But that's John Runyon, man, that's the dude that I look up to, and he's a beast, man.
Isn't that great? All right, let's get some questions. We got some people coming with, yes, ma'am, you, people coming with microphones.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for talking with us and Let's Go Birds forever.
Yeah.
I was hoping for a little inspiration for all of us, those of us who are adults and struggle, and I teach students who are high level and sometimes put a lot of pressure on themselves. what words of wisdom would you have for us that don't involve a word that will get me fired? If you don't mind.
Yeah, you might have come to the wrong lecture. You know what? I believe in this, right? How to do it and how to deal with people is based on individuals, right? I truly believe that. I don't think it's just there's one way of doing things. I think you got to treat each student with individuality and understand where they come from and what they've been through. But I believe this. Don't listen to yourself. Talk to yourself. And you got to motivate these kids in a way that they can understand that they can do whatever they want. They can be whatever they want. But who they hang out with and how they talk to themselves, how they view themselves, when they look in the mirror, the way that they talk to themselves, it's the same way when they leave that door, they're going to talk to the world, see the world, and treat the world. And it's super easy. If you ask a kid, are you depressed? Yeah. Do you tell yourself you're depressed every day? Yeah. Well, okay, well, let's try something else. Why don't every time you think you're depressed, why don't you think of something good, think of something happy? Tell yourself you're happy and just give it a shot. And see if you can convince yourself that there's something more in this world and there's something better in your future. But if you can't see it, and if you don't believe it, and you can't tell yourself it's there, you ain't never going to find it. Because right now, you're going down the path that you're talking to yourself about. And that's depression. So when I work with kids, that's what I do. We just try and talk positive. Don't even go there. And just realize that the words matter. So I don't know if that makes a difference, but it's that's what I did to myself, and I just would never let myself go down the wrong path. I don't know.
Yes. Dan.
Appreciate you being with the Eagles. I'm a season ticket holder since 81.
Well, dude, thank those two guys in the back, man. So those guys could have fired me at any time.
Well, I stayed because you were there. America's Got Talent. Tell us about your experience with that.
Yeah, please. We kind of missed that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of missed a couple things, but yeah, it was awesome.
There's a lot of stuff in this book.
I know, it's man. Like... So long story short, I do it. And a friend of mine convinces me. And I didn't tell the team. This is great. I didn't tell the team. And so my goal was, because they shoot like in March and April, which is the off season, and then they edit it all, and then they air pre-taped stuff for like the first month or two of the show, and then it goes into the live show, which you compete on stage in August, which is training camp. So I do one episode. My goal was just to get Simon or somebody to say something good, promote my speaking career, use it in marketing, be done, right? But I actually go to the second round, and the second round was going to film in like 2 weeks. So I'm like, I'm still off. I'll just go to the second round. I go on stage. And I'm literally telling myself, oh, this is perfect. I'll get them to say a few things. I'll go off stage. I'll opt out. We're good. Well, they give me that gold buzzer, right? If you watch the clip online, I turn around and walk to the back of the stage. Because I kid you not, in my head, I said, oh. And then I'm like, dude, the Eagles don't know. This isn't airing till July. So if I opt out now, this never airs and never happened, right? So I'm like, okay, I don't want that to happen, right? Because then... they'll just reset the gold buzzer, give it to some other, but then that never happened. I'm like, no, screw that. I ain't gonna say nothing. So now all of a sudden, July comes, and that episode airs right before training camp, and I'm like, okay, this is gonna be interesting. This episode's gonna air. I get the gold buzzer. NBC's gonna call the Eagles and be like, I can't believe you excused John from training camp. And the Eagles have no idea. So then I go, and I'll be darned, man, those two dudes right back there, the owner. They come up to me and they're like, dude, why didn't you say something? I go, well, you know, you kind of knew, but like, I didn't really think I was going to go this far. But don't worry about it, dude. I'm here for training camp. I'm going to opt out. They're like, no, you're not. This is your dream, man. Magic saved your life. How can we make this work? And that's what Don and Frank said, right? And then I'll never forget, Jeff Lurie goes like this. The owner, he goes, and let's be honest, John, it's not like you're a quarterback. Thank you, Jeff, for almost calling me an athlete. Almost. And so I don't think the team realized the extent that I was doing this, but like multiple times in weeks, I was training camp from 8 to 5. I had a 6 o'clock flight that I had American Airlines escort me to my plane, and they would put me on this flight. I wouldn't have, you know, I'd have my own TSA, so they really helped me out. I would then fly from LA at 6, and I'd land and have about an hour and a half or 2 hours to do B-roll. They had a warehouse space by LAX, and we do some rehearsal, B-roll, camera blocking, interviews. I'd get on a 10:15 flight to take the red eye back to LA, land at 7:15 to then go over to the NovaCare. Thank God it was by the airport. And I would hit my 8 o'clock meeting, and I would do that multiple times, right? It was the most chaotic time of my life. I missed one team meeting that the team excused me from. They could have fined me like 50 G's, but like they excused me from it, right? Oh yeah, in the NFL, we get fined for everything, so don't worry about that, right? They excused me because there was a shooter at LAX, and what happened is one of the golf carts, you know, that they drive people on, it backfired. right? So they shut the airport down, and I made my special teams meeting. So I'm really proud to say that during that time, I went back and forth, LA to Philly, never missed a special teams meeting, never missed a practice, never missed a game, never missed a rehearsal, never missed a performance. And it was by far, for me, it was the coolest thing in the world to be my two loves, Magic and football. I played in a game against Cleveland, and then guess what? After the game, thank you. You know what's better than having a plane? Having a friend that owns a plane. I played in a game against Cleveland to board his plane to go to LA to right then perform on the finals of America's Got Talent. I got to do my two loves on the top stages in the world simultaneously. It was cool. That's awesome. Rockstar.
Yeah. Other questions? Yes, right there.
Do you think your years of practicing magic made you a better long snapper?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It trained my mind to find what I love. And we're all wired differently. And reading for me is really hard, right? And I found out where I learn and where I get obsessed. Doing something over and over and over in search of the perfect rep all day long. I can do one move over and over and over for hours and not get tired of that in search of the perfect rep. Long snapping's that. It's you're literally doing something, the same thing over and over and over in search of the perfect rep. And so magic taught me that it doesn't matter how hard something is, just stick with it and you'll figure it out and it'll be good. And it got to the point that I was proud. In like 2014, I was voted by the Pro Football Focus, which is all the scouts and I think media. I'm probably wrong on that, but it's probably nobody. It's probably some little 10-year-old at home, right? but they voted me the most accurate snapper in the game, and they told me that like 98.7% of my snaps were dead on, laces included. So like on field goals, you want the holder to catch it and put it down and not move the ball, which means the laces are sticking out. And so you hit the same speed, same place, the holder catches it in the same spot, my ball would spin 3.5 times, he would catch it, put it down, laces out, not move it, and it gives a better target for the kicker. So that's what Donnie and I would do. Donnie was the punter holder. We'd go over there, and I'd work on hitting the same speed, same ball, same amount of spins, he'd catch it in the same spot, and you just do that over and over. And I love that repetition. I can get lost in that repetition. Yeah. Which, isn't that exciting?
John, thanks for being here. Couple statements. I read the book and absolutely loved all the motivation that you have in there. I mean, you can take something away in every aspect of your life from what you talked about in the book. And more so even than the quotes at the beginning of each chapter, I loved your motivation, what you talked about, thanks. Not what some of the famous people talked about. And in this day and age of technology, I loved how many hours you spoke with your wife before you even went on a date.
Yeah, so
that was unbelievable to me.
Yeah, so here's what happened. Right, this was 5 years ago, and I'm newly divorced, and I'm going to tell you one story, and I'll clean it. So basically what happens is, my buddy, where's Tim? Where's the big man? Stand up.
Yeah.
So this guy right here, that's the
Tim
big Mooney.
Man.
Tim Mooney, the big man. So here's what happens. That guy right there, right? That guy right there decides he's going to introduce me to a chick. The moment I tell him, if I ever talk about marriage, you punch me right square in the face. So I'm newly divorced, happy, and he goes, hey, I got this chick you got to meet. Oh, here we go. And so, now, I mean, no disrespect, but this is the way the story went. And it wasn't that I didn't want a relationship, and it's not that I just wanted to, like, date all these chicks. I just didn't want to worry about anybody else. I'd just gotten out of a marriage. I just wanted to find myself again. And so what happens is he goes, yeah, no, she's a 6-foot blonde from Vegas. And I was like, oh, sounds like a winner. Awesome. How about this? Tell her we'll go out, we'll have fun. If we go on a vacation, great. But I'll be honest, just at this time in my life, I probably won't call her back. Just tell her that. He goes, okay, cool. So he calls her. Hey, and now she was an executive at MGM. She helped run 11 casinos. Hey, Annalise. Yeah, what's going on, Tim? And he obviously knew both of us. Hey, I got this guy you got to meet. Oh, here we go, Tim. I can't find love in Vegas. There's no guys. All right, well, who is he? What does he do? His name's John. He plays in the NFL. And she goes, want nothing to do with that scumbag. And so that's how we met. And he got us on a phone call that we thought we were on the phone for something else. Long story short, we actually got along. And I was in Philly. She was in Vegas. We talked on the phone for 4 or 5 months before we ever met. And all of a sudden, that, you know, 30 seconds, and then little funny videos, and then all night, and then laying there FaceTiming, going, good night, no, you good night. And then we wake up, and we're both snoring on FaceTime. And then I went to Vegas months later. We had dinner one time. We agreed to not, you know, and as adults, right, that's all I need to say, because heavens forbid something pops out 9 months later. We don't want to say it was a one-night stand in Vegas. Can't do that. So, yeah, hopefully that was, it doesn't matter. You guys are paying attention to the wrong details. And so what happens is she had a work event, and she says, hey, I'm going to, you know, the next day, I'll just go spend a few days with me. So she's probably going to be promoted to vice president. And she basically, we spent 3 days together. She quit her job. And we didn't call Tim because this is our first date. We hadn't talked to him in a few days. And so Tim calls us and goes, so, hey, how did the first date go? I haven't heard from you guys. Oh, yeah, it was great, man. she quit her job. She's moving in. No, come on. No, yeah, she quit her job and she's moving in. He's like, what? Yeah, and if we get married, you're going to marry us on a beach in Mexico. Got to go. Bye, Tim. And sure enough, we got married on a small beach in Mexico, and that guy right there, he got ordained by unitedministries.org. And we got married, and I'm going to tell you right now, it's been the best 5 years of my life, so I guess when you know, you know, and it's all good. Yeah. Yeah. Are we going to do something?
Yeah, do it.
All right, hey, come up here. Come here. Yeah, I've never done this before, so there's a reason why I've never done this on TV, because I don't really know how long this is going to take. So it's just a velvet bag. You can, oh, God, I'm sorry. Yeah, just whatever you do, don't drop it. Okay. Put your hand in there. You can check it out. You can feel it. We're going to use somebody else. Come here, sir. Come up on the stage, okay? I want you to hold these and just scroll through them, and I want you to notice if you notice, don't drop them. Okay. Notice if you notice something. Just scroll through them. And you're going to notice that they're in brand new deck order, which means it's ace through king, king through ace, in numerical order by suit. Okay? You can turn that bag inside out. You can do whatever you want. Make sure there's nothing in it. There's no doors. There's nothing in there. It's just a beautiful blue velvet bag. Okay, here we go. Here's what I got. And I know it's going to be kind of hard to see, but you guys will see this. These are in what's called numerical order, right, by suit. So are you ready? Come here. All I want you to do is say the word stop.
Stop.
Okay, take it and look at it. Don't step on your glasses. They're right there. That's not a magic trick. That's just you. Hey, and then just kind of show it to the crowd, okay? And if you guys can see it, great. If you can't, just pretend like you can and be like, oh, it's amazing, okay? Hey, are you ready? And now look, say stop.
Stop.
Put it right there. And I know that these are in numerical order, so obviously that's the only card out of order, okay? But you can overhand shuffle like this. You can do what's called a bridge shuffle like this, right? And now you can shuffle these guys up in all different ways. This right here, this is called a slop shuffle. It's when you take some cards facing this way, and some cards facing that. Can you guys see this? And so normally there'd be a camera on stage, and you guys would really see this. But you can shuffle these guys face up into face down. So now when you go through here, can you guys see that they're all mixed up?
Yeah.
Face up into face down. You can take those and shuffle them up. Now come over here. Come over here. And I want you to, and if you want, you can drop them in the bag, and then use the bag as like a mixing pot, right? Oh, look at you. Look at you, stud. Man. Put them in the bag. Put your hand in the bag and now just mix them up in the bag, okay? And then you hold the bag and then you put your hand in there, yeah? And then are you ready? Come right here, come right here. And dump those cards out on the floor.
Will I have to pick them up?
Yep, no, I will, I got it. So here we go. So now you can see that these things are all mixed up. These are face up, face down, and it's just a complete mess. Would you guys agree that that's what's going on here?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Your card might be face up, it might be face down. Half of you guys can't see the stage, so you're like, I'll take your word for it. And I'm going to do this. Now, this is what I mean by I don't really know how long this is going to take, because this is something that I've been working on. I usually do this on a table, but we don't have a table. So I will show you this move. I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, I call this move. Watch yourself. Don't fall. That's a whole different trick. Here we go. I call this move walking the dog. Killing it. do me a favor. We got cards all face up, face down. Name your card out loud. And what I'm going to try and do is go through here and do what's called glimpse shuffling, which means as I'm shuffling and breaking, I'm actually eyeballing cards. Right, that helped. Okay, I just want to make sure that it was a thorough shuffle. Okay, yeah, just like that. Do me a favor. Name your card out loud. Two hearts? Perfect. So when I was a kid, this is what I would do. I would sit at my table and I would riffle shuffle. And as I would shuffle, I'd get glimpses of cards. And when I literally told you that I would spend my entire life shuffling cards like this and trying to put cards back in order, that's what I was doing. Taking cards that were face up into face down, splitting them, getting glimpses of them, and again, trying to get all the cards to face the same direction. Don't get your hopes up. I don't know if this is going to work yet, okay? So let's not, don't get too excited. I'm still trying to figure out how to do this thing. I wish I had a table, but I don't. And, okay, and so hopefully, if you go through here, I believe in this right here. May every one of us make the decision that when life's shuffling us up, when life's kicking us down, stand up. Don't listen to yourself, talk to yourself, live in vision, not circumstance. I've spent my entire life trying to get cards in order as I try and figure out how to get my life in order. You named a card. What was it? I did nothing except shuffle them at the end. You shuffle them. You shuffle them. You put them in the bag and shuffle them. You examine the bag. You dumped them out on the stage. I picked them up. They were all different directions, face up, face down. I thought I would go through here and put every single card. Ooh, I don't want to expose that because I want to build this up. Get every card to face the same direction except one, two, three, four cards. Every one of these cards that was face up, face down are now all facing the same direction. You said you picked a two of hearts. There's one two. There's a two. There's a two. And ladies and gentlemen, there are the four twos facing one direction. And all of these are now facing the right direction right there. I might actually do that in my show because it worked. So thank you guys. I don't know if we have time for Q, if we're signing. I don't know what we're doing here. But
we're going to go. Yeah. John's going to sign books.
Yeah.
And
Don and Frank, I love you. Thanks for coming.
How about Magic Man?
Yeah, baby. Oh, hey, and do me a favor. If you read the book, go on Amazon and leave a rating and a review, because it makes a big difference for a lot. Hey, and the other thing, too, is when you do the review, it helps with the bestseller list. And I'll be honest with you, not one of my English teachers thought I'd be published or a bestseller. So kind of want to stick it to them.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.